versus Jantz.
Good morning. Chris Rossford on behalf of Lane Tollefson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The first issue that the court must decide is whether or not a higher evidentiary standard must be applied when the court is deciding a motion for summary judgment in a defamation case. In the Anderson case, the United States Supreme Court determined that the court needs to be guided by the evidentiary standards that apply to the case at trial. In the case of defamation, that is a standard of preponderance of the evidence, except for the element of malice, actual malice. In order to prevail on her claims, Ms. Tollefson must show first that the defendants made false statements, false and defamatory statements that are of and concerning her. In this case, the statements were of and concerning Ms. Tollefson.
And how do we know that?
First, in the book and in the clarification and in the radio interview, Mr. Jantz does not identify the teacher by name, but he does identify his son's name, Greg. He said that he was in sixth grade at the time. It's not necessary that every single person that hears the statement identify, believe that the person referred to is in fact the complaining plaintiff. It's enough if a portion of the audience would understand that that's who the defendant was referring to. In this case, the defendants point out that there was three sixth grade teachers, and that Dr. Jantz could have been referring to any of those three teachers. However,
so you're saying that there is circumstantial evidence to indicate that the parents of the other parents and other teachers knew.
Other teachers, parents, administrators, maybe not all of them would have identified it, but a portion of them could have, based on the fact that Dr. Jantz is a prominent figure in the King School Christian Ministries. So their other parents are going to know that his son attended school there. Other kids, the parents of the other students in that sixth grade class would know that.
The clock is running, so help me understand how it's defamatory.
It's defamatory because it never occurred.
That would go to falsity, right?
Yes.
And how does it defame the teacher?
How does it defame her? It defames her because, number one, if it were true, she's violating school policy. She's violating Washington criminal law.
Cite in the brief, there's no citation to any criminal law statutes. Is there anyone in particular that you were referencing? I mean, are you saying an unlawful delivery of a controlled substance?
Yes, would be under the books.
What about the cure? I'm not sure the statutory term for it. The cure statement that was read over the radio, saying we certainly didn't mean to intend. Apparently, that's lawful that they can say that. So, doesn't that cure it if there's ever an issue?
I don't believe so, because he's still saying that it occurred. What he does is they artfully worded it to say, "Well, that's what I believe." Well, you can always come back and say, "Well, that's what I believed," but it doesn't. Fix the statement because it's still saying it occurred. He's just saying, well, I thought it was, you know, the had been authorized by the parents and the medication was legally prescribed. It still, you know, has the hint that, you know, this occurred, and maybe he doesn't believe that anything was wrong, but he's still saying that it did happen. And that's why we believe it's not actually a clarification.
Doesn't it suggest that it's school policy, though? I mean, it's school policy that if you're, you know, if you have a child who's been prescribed these drugs, that how you get them is by the teacher making sure that you take them every morning. I mean, so it doesn't sound like he's suggesting that there's anything incorrect that the teacher's doing. He might be criticizing the policy, but that it's hard to see where the teacher is accused of violating some law or violating school policy. It sounds like she's acting consistent with school policy.
Well, I think what the defendant trying to do is get around the fact that they're saying that it did happen. You know, if you tell somebody that maybe he's not directly accused, he says he's not directly accusing her of wrongdoing, but, you know, simply cutting that out does not change the nature of the statement. He's still saying that did occur. And if that was occurring, she was violating school policy, and she was potentially committing criminal acts. So it's similar to, you know, saying that, you know, you saw somebody taking drugs, but you don't have the belief that it's wrong. You thought it was fine, but you told somebody, and that person disagrees, and you know, the person you're talking about gets in trouble.
Well, following up on Spearman's question, wouldn't the average listener assume that it was lawful for the school to administer or supervise the administration of drugs? What is it about the statement itself that you would infer that the teacher, unnamed, is committing some kind of unlawful act?
Well, I think it's capable of defamatory meaning, and that's, you know, if it's true, then she was violating school policy. May I finish? School policy, criminal laws. And then it's up to the jury to determine whether or not it was actually defamatory. So I think that's the answer to your question.
Thank you. You've got 3 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Becca Doran for the defendants, and Dr. Jantz is here in the courtroom today. You know, this is a lawsuit in which, you know, Ms. Tollefson, a teacher, argues defamation simply by a statement that an unnamed teacher at an unnamed school supervised students taking medication in the classroom. This cannot support a claim for defamation as a matter of law, and there are four reasons we believe that
Aren't
you
there
should.
A number of folks at the school who knew that the child was in this teacher's class knew about the incident that occurred. It's a fairly, I mean, it's not a huge community. It's a fairly small community. It's a school. Mr. Jantz is a person that's known in that community. Can we at least draw an inference for purposes of summary judgment that people in that school would know where this influential person's child is in class?
I don't believe you can, and I think you would need some admissible evidence that somebody recognized who she was. And what you have here is...
So we've got the plaintiff's declaration where she says that one teacher texted her about the radio show and that another teacher showed her a passage from the book. Why isn't that proper evidence?
Those are hearsay, Your Honor.
Why is that hearsay?
Because she is trying to say that two people recognized her from the passage and the broadcast. But
how did you become aware of the broadcast? Someone else told me about it.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's...
Is that hearsay?
No, it depends on what...
How did you become aware of the passage of the book? Someone else called it to my attention. Is that hearsay?
I think it depends on, hearsay is dependent on what the statement is being admitted to prove.
How did you become aware of the passage in the book another teacher showed it to me. Is that hearsay?
Again, Your Honor, I'm sorry to...
Is that hearsay? It's a direct question. Hearsay law is pretty straightforward.
If it is used...
Her statement is, another teacher showed it to me.
If the purpose is to show...
How is that statement hearsay?
If the purpose is to show that that's how she became aware, it is not hearsay.
Okay. So then it's admissible. So if it's admissible under hearsay law, then we go to the rules of procedure with regard to Rule 56 motions. One person called her attention to the broadcast. One person called her attention to the book. Neither called any other teacher's attention to either of these things. Isn't it, there's no evidence that that's so. Doesn't that give rise to an inference that those two people thought the broadcast and the book were referring to her?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that that's not
true. You can disagree with me, but tell me how it's not true.
I'm not saying it's not true.
The inference can be drawn, right?
I understand that you feel an inference can be drawn, and the fact is...
Well, it's not that I feel an inference can be drawn. Under the law, an inference can be drawn, correctly?
I think if the evidence was admissible and not hearsay, yes.
Okay, well, we've already established that it's not hearsay, though. You want to circle back around, so let's go back to it. How did you learn of the broadcast is the question. The answer is... A person texted me about it. Is that a hearsay answer?
If it is used to show that she became aware in that manner, no, it is not hearsay.
Then we're done. If it's admissible for any reason, it's admissible. So now we're done. We've got it in, and it gives rise to an inference.
I understand, Your Honor, and respectfully, I have 6 minutes left, and I don't think that is the focus of this, or should be the focus of the court's decision. The focus should be what Judge Trickey was asking about, which is whether the statement is capable of a defamatory meaning.
I'll take that you're abandoning your claim that this couldn't be relied on. Then that's fine. If we don't want to discuss anymore, I'm game for that. If you agree that should not have been excluded, then I'm fine with it.
Your Honor, I don't agree with you, but I don't have any more to offer you than I've already offered you.
Okay.
So with respect to whether the statement is capable of a defamatory meaning, both parties agree this is a threshold question of law for the court. And I think it's important to look at the actual text of the statements and the context. The context was a book about the difference in ways that boys and girls learn. And it was specifically in this passage talking about the fact that the authors believe that boys are over-medicated for attention disorders. And the statements are in the book. Dr. Jantz's sixth-grade son, quote, reported at the start of each day, a line of boys paraded up to the teacher's desk and took some sort of pill. And in the broadcast, I asked my son, will you count for me how many kids take a pill in the morning at school? I think he counted there were 6 to 8 boys that would go forward each day, and they have to take their pill in front of the teacher. Contrast this with what Ms. Tollefson says she's been accused of, committing thousands of counts of felony distribution of a controlled substance to her students, punishable by up to 20 years for each count. As a matter of law, the statement is not capable of that meaning. There's no accusation of wrongdoing in the statement itself. In fact, the defendants went out of their way in the book and the broadcast to say, we're not blaming teachers for this attention, the sort of misdiagnosis of boys with attention disorders. In fact, teachers are good, are good people. They're trying to do the right thing. There's simply no insinuation here that can be read into the court as a matter of law, read into the statement as a matter of law by the court, that Ms. Tollefson committed a criminal offense.
What's your view of the standard of proof that the summary judgment judge has to apply at that stage?
Your Honor, I think, quite honestly, the question is unsettled in this state. I think that the Washington Supreme Court has said that in Moore versus Grant. You have Mark versus Seattle Times from the 80s, which said it is clear and convincing evidence for every element. Then you have Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, which Mr. Rossford mentioned, and then you have Howder versus Coles, which says no, that's not the rule, and then you have, but that's an appellate court decision, not the Supreme Court, and then you have Moore versus Grant saying it's unsettled. I would advocate that it should be convincing clarity, but I don't think it's settled, and I don't think you have to decide that in this case, because I think whether you apply preponderance of the evidence or convincing clarity, that you should rule in favor of the respondents. The clarification itself also cannot be defamatory, and I think this is a real illustration of the flaws in Ms. Tollefson's claims. If you look at the clarification statute, one way to abide by it is to disclaim the specific implication that is alleged to be defamatory.
I found that statute fascinating. I wasn't aware of it until I
read
it in the briefs. There's no what if the people who heard the first two statements didn't hear the clarification? Isn't there a isn there an argument to be made to the jury that it came later and no one heard it? I mean, how does that all work together factually? I get the legal argument, but how does that work factually at summary judgment?
Well, I think the legislature has decided that if the clarification meets the standards of the statute, i.e., it is broadcast in the same medium to the same audience with the same prominence, that as a matter of law, there can be no presumed damages in those cases.
As a matter of law.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's exactly what happened here. And notably, you know, we gave Ms. Tolson an opportunity to review the correction or clarification beforehand, and she said that's not accurate, but didn't tell us what wasn't accurate about it. And then on top of that, when we were looking for an extension, we didn't make the clarification. It just didn't work. I mean, you know, and the fact is, the point of the clarification was to disclaim the intent to imply anything wrong happened.
Going back to the defamatory statement, circumstantial evidence, I think that's the point Judge Dwyer was getting at.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you have a circumstantial case, is there circumstantial evidence here that the delivery was somehow illegal? That a jury could decide?
No, Your Honor, not that I can think of. In fact, it's notably under Washington law, any employee at a school can be trained to dispense medication. It would be like someone saying, in a different context, my lawyer called the court. Was it ex parte? I don't know. I mean, are we now accusing the lawyer of violating the ethics rules by calling the court? Or if I said, I bought the judge lunch so that we could talk about how the judicial system is broken. Is the judge accepted a gift improperly? I don't know. I mean, these are the kinds of things that would be subject to liability as if you were to reverse the Superior Court and find that summary judgment shouldn't have been granted. I also think that there's an absence of damages in this case, and that is what the Superior Court appeared to focus on during the oral argument.
She said she was traumatized by this. Isn't that enough?
She didn't.
That's my word. That's not her word.
No. She said she suffered depression and emotional distress. But it wasn't clear to me from her declaration that she actually said it was a result of the statement in the book, as opposed to what happened afterwards, i.e. the fact that she filed a lawsuit and that the school ended up terminating her contract for whatever reason. It certainly wasn't. I don't think there's any dispute in the record that it was not because of the implication that she found in the book. And then there's been no showing of actual malice or no attempt to, I mean, notably, I think you guys, you know.
She's not a public figure, though.
No, but to get presumed damages, you have to prove actual malice.
Okay.
And she didn't actually ask for any, under Rule 56F, she didn't ask for any discovery. So it's not as if she said, I could prove actual malice if I could get discovery. She simply didn't do that. And so you have to decide based on the record before you whether summary judgment should have been granted, and we believe it should.
Thank you. I would like to go back and address the question regarding the defamatory nature of the statement. Again, it's the court simply decides whether or not the statement is capable of defamatory meaning. And it's the jury who decides whether or not it actually defamed the plaintiff. In this case, it's simply... It's not necessary that there was actual harm to be found to be capable of defamatory meaning. It's just need to show that there's a general tendency to have that effect. And again, if these statements were actually true, that she was dispensing medication in her classroom, again, she was never authorized to do that, and she never did do that. And if that were the case, she'd be violating school policy and the criminal law, and that would affect her reputation if that were true. Another issue is that the statement itself is false. The defendant, respondents, attempt to basically remove Ms. Tollefson from the equation and say, well, this is what my son told me, and they assert that that's true.
How does the clarification statement affect that then? I mean, if I understand the respondent's argument, they're saying as a matter of law, that cures whatever problem there exists.
I disagree, because the statement, it doesn't, it didn't clarify. It's only self-serving. He says, well, I didn't believe that. You could make any statement and come back and say, well, I didn't really believe it. I expected you readers to believe that it was okay.
Well, that might be consistent with the legislative determination that we want to give a lot of weight to the First Amendment.
Well, at the same time, you know, you've got Ms. Tolfson's right to a jury trial as well, access to the courts. And I think that needs to be weighed as well. And I think that's why Anderson and changed the standard for defamation cases and said, no, it's not. There's not a higher standard. It's the burden that the plaintiff has at trial. And I'm running out of time, so thank you. Right. We ask the court to reverse.
Thank you very much.